Worst week yet. I will work on a song, like a real song.
Yeah, I feel like it should be way longer.
Well, I mean, listen.
I think it was the right amount of time. It was like, it reminded me of my first marriage.
Ba-dum-bum. I did it again. There we go.
Every time you try to do ba-dum-bum-ch or whatever, you add like five other sounds. You'll add the fucking, you'll somehow add that to it. And it's like, those are two different sound effects. But I appreciate it. You're putting in a lot of work, Maria.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Worst Week Yet bonus episode. It's the one that you pay for.
Yeah.
It's every fucking week is the worst week yet. Listeners, thank you so much for getting involved, getting on board, giving us money to do this stupid shit. We have a special treat for you. As you've probably figured out by reading the episode description, it's not just me and Maria this week. Maria, you've invited your friend on. Why don't you introduce
them? Close personal friend, Jen Abreu.
Do you want to like?
Thank you for the stellar introduction.
Oh my god! No, Jen works at she works in a California prison, and she's gonna tell us about her program today. Jen's a fucking rock star. She does, you know, if people say like social workers do God's work and stuff. Jen actually does God's work. If God's real, if you believe, I don't know.
If God's real, he definitely has a job.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, if anybody's picking themselves up by their bootstraps it's our
Lord and Savior. But no, Jen's working with, she's been working with a group of guys for, how long have you ran that program for?
Since late 2016, early 2017 is when I started going inside maximum security prisons in Southern California.
Yeah, and that's how, well, you and I became friends, well, through, like, the Bernie movement, but that was also, the fact that, you know, you were into criminal justice and I was a juvenile justice fucking person over here, like, we connected. But it's grown, because you started it, right, like, as a school project, right?
Well, okay, I think that's a nice way to dress up. I got into a fight in school about criminal justice.
Yes. That's a nice way to say that you got in a fight.
Yeah, that's like, you know, going down a water slide with no water right there. So
wait, hold on. I'm sorry. Isn't that then just a slide?
Not if you're wearing a swimsuit.
I mean, I sweat so much. Every slide is a water slide, but I get what you're saying.
No, so it really kind of just started. Hi, my name is Jen Abreu, and I am the president and CEO of Redemption Row, California. So I will guess, I will just kind of get into this, is prior to the pandemic, I was running a evidence-based self-help workshop inside California prisons in male facilities. And the program is called the Alternatives to Violence Project, and it's the only self-help secular program that is offered in CDCR outside of education that actually has data behind it. So everything else, like, you know, Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, Criminal Gangs Anonymous, all of that is really good, you know, theory. But it's not rooted in any kind of data. So basically, when my punk ass walks onto a prison yard, you're getting a proven model of success.
There you go. Thank you. By the way, hi, I'm Andrew. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's nice to meet you.
Sorry, we recorded an earlier podcast today too. But you've been doing this for so long, and that's why, well, you know, I've just always wanted to have you on because you're a home, you're my friend. But, like, what I love about it, it's, like, something that, like, it's trauma-informed, right?
Yes,
and it's
absolutely
something that we don't see in a lot of prisons, and we should have. It, you know, honestly, I think some of your program teaches people how to, you know, even be more humane and more empathetic.
Yeah.
You know
very
what I mean?
So.
And
I do.
Like, it goes back to this, you know, argument of, like, you know, can you teach a person empathy? And are these people in prison truly, like, you know, antisocial or whatever? But I do truly think that you can help people. I don't think that everybody is, like, the, you know, damaged goods, right? Like, I think it's extremely rare.
Very rare.
Especially in a prison, you know? Mm-hmm. You got to think, and a lot of these guys, I mean, they've probably, you know, from what I, the experiences that I've had with working with guys in prison is they have, like, this horrific trauma behind them. And nobody looks at community trauma as trauma. Right. And I remember you and I having, like, a very early conversation about that, of, like, how the community and how even the systems at large continue to, you know, perpetuate this trauma on, you know, a very vulnerable population.
Yeah, it does. You know, I would say in my workshops, you know, I have anywhere from 20 to 25 men in a room with me all weekend on a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And, you know, the stories of childhood trauma that are on the spectrum from, you know, poverty to domestic abuse to sexual abuse, you know, bad public school systems, you know, systems that are meant to uplift and mobilize, are not, they're quite antithetical. Having, you know, the war on drugs decimate your community, right? And you're, there's just, I sit in rooms of, you know, this is how I explain it to these guys. You know, the Russian nesting dolls.
Yeah.
Right. And okay. So So the babushkas or whatever they are. And so inside, if you take one off and you finally get down, you have a little one. Well, that's how men in prison truly are. You have to start peeling away these rough exteriors, because inside all of them is a damaged little boy. Right.
I want to just jump in here. I haven't spoken to many men in prison, or even like proportionately that many men, but I'm willing to say that that's how all men are.
True. Right. Right. Exactly.
I know there's a sad little crying boy inside of me. He motivates a lot of the stupid things that I do. Right. So yeah, men, it's time we open up the rushing nesting dolls in our own selves. sorry. Yeah.
Show us your little boy.
Yeah. Little boy.
So Jen, you've been working on this for some time, but I guess recently, you became involved with a, let's say a little bit more of a high profile case, which has made you a very, in demand personality, which is, both cool and also sounds kind of terrifying.
Right.
So you've been, where have you appeared? Besides obviously the prestigious Worst Week Yet Patreon episode.
Right. Right. I mean, you can find me at my local dive bar. No. I've been doing a lot of press, based on, the, Sirhan parole board hearing that I was, intimately involved with. But yeah, I just finished up doing a piece for CNN that's coming out, I think, Monday night. CBS Nightly News, The New York Post, The Intercept, The Hill. And then there's a lot of other kind of like sub publications that have come out after that that are really fun to read. I'm literally waiting for my moment where I'm like in line and there's like my face next to Sirhan's and like a bunch of mafia members. And they're like, these are the people that got him out, you know, on the Inquirer. And I'll be like, yeah, I finally made it, you know?
And then me and Maria hanging out, smoking Newports, being like, yeah, we got her too.
That's
CNN
right.
CNN had her. Yeah. You know?
Well, that's the thing though, is, you know, I mean, I always take care of, you know, my supporters, and definitely Maria and has always been a supporter of my work. One of the first interviews I did was, for a, what was it called? Voices, out of Sacramento. And it was, you know, they have a small, for, I guess, a national standings wise, you know, little podcast that they do. And, you know, I learned a lot by sitting on there, you know, kind of talking about things. There was really good points made by everybody. And this is where I think the most intimate conversations have is on the, you know, some smaller publications. CNN just wants to hear, you know, what they want to hear so they can get it on and then move on to something else. And that's fine, because we know that a lot of people, you know, eat at that trough.
Right.
But for me, it's being able to unpack all of these things and having that time in a critical listening audience that understands that it's way more fun and sexy to punch up than it is to punch down. So
yeah. Yeah.
That's how I feel.
It's a lot of work too. I mean, I know you and I have talked about just the trauma that goes into working with all of these cases, but at the same time you get these wins like this and you're just, that's what it's about. You know what I mean? Like that's all what it's about. I mean, I know you and I like, I'm sorry, Andrew. I'm like, feel like I'm cutting you out of the conversation.
You're all good. I have no idea what we're talking about.
No,
so.
No, but we're I'm just here talking
to,
about.
I'm just here to hop in with stupid jokes or misandry, I think. Is did I use that word right?
I don't know what that word means. but like, you get these wins like this, and it's fucking huge. You know what I mean?
Yeah, now, it is.
Now, also. Suge Knight also played a role in this.
Well, let's if we want to talk about it, we should, do you want to like, just kind of like start us from the beginning, of this case or is this
for sure?
Okay.
Yeah,
cool.
Let's do that. So, basically what happened was I was, slated to go into, Richard J. Donovan Correctional Facility here in San Diego, and to create some evidence-based self-help programs. Mm-hmm. One of them was a program that Suge Knight wanted to start, which he's incarcerated here at RJ Donovan. And he had heard of my work in another facility. And so there was a connection there. And he said, I'd love to do, like, incorporate the nonviolence curriculum that you have with, you know, like a creative writing and music program. How do we kind of smash these two concepts together? And so we worked on that for quite some time, on what that would flesh out and what kind of people could we bring in for this. And we were well on our way to making this a reality. And then all of a sudden we got COVID and the facility shut down and nobody was allowed to go inside and program. So I have an inside team that I've been working with for some time. Cameron Morris and Joel Baptiste, they both came from, I guess, my home prison that I started off at Calipatria. And these two guys are personally trained in conflict resolution by me. And they had transferred over to Donovan here in San Diego. And so they were friends. They became friends with Suge. And it was actually through them that Suge was able to reach out to me, because they said, you know, we got a lady that can do this radical shit. She's with the business. And so that's kind of how I became introduced to Mr. Knight. And then, like I said, COVID hit. And so there was no programming. I couldn't get in. And the programs that I run, you can't do it like remotely. It's not like homework, right? It's an experiential workshop. We sit together. We're doing a lot of shit together.
Yeah, that kind of like sharing or like peeling back the vulnerable layers. Like it's, you know, you can't do that quite the same on Zoom.
No, you can't. You really can't. And then that wasn't even a reality, having anything done, you know, video wise. Yeah. And so like I continued to send in like some academic material to keep their brains engaged with things. And, you know, we did a lot of like shame, guilt and violence. A lot of like threading those things through, just in keeping their mind, you know, super engaged on the topics. But that was really, that was my level of participation. And then my lead teammate, Mr. Baptiste, came to me and he said, you know what, here's something, he said, I thought of, and I want you to think about. And he said, ever since, he said, for the longest time, I have been helping lifers get themselves prepared for their parole board date. Yep. And that looks like a lot of clerical work, you know, making sure their paperwork is all together, that their file is, you know, really comprehensive, that they are seen as the person that they are, not the person that they were.
Mitigation.
And, right. And so he's like, I've been working with them and I look at, you know, where is this person lacking? You know, is this something I can help him with and discuss these things? And then there was another gentleman, his name is Mark Pfeiffer, and Mark had created a curriculum and actually had a class approved to do just this specific thing, is to meet with lifers and get them ready for parole. And CDCR said, you know what, this is a remarkable curriculum that you have, and we're going to approve it. In fact, if guys go to your program, we'll give them good time credits because it was like really amazing. Right. And so, between Mark and Joelle's experience with preparing people for board, out of 20 lifers that they have helped get ready for board, 19 of them have been granted dates and are on the street being positive people in their society. And I thought, God damn it, that is a metric I can get behind. Mm-hmm. This is a winning, successful model. And so they said, okay, cool. So good. You're on board. Okay, cool. So we have an idea. And I was like, all right, well, give it to me. And they said, we would like to get Sirhan Sirhan ready for his board. And this was a year out from his parole board date.
Can I ask you a question real quick?
Please, of course.
How often do parole board things happen?
Oh, they happen every week.
Per prisoner, like...
It goes based upon
your sentence.
It does, but it also goes based upon once you get if you get denied, the parole board has this criteria. They can usually they will deny for 7 years, 5 years, or 3 years. And so Sirhan was always denied 7 years, and then you started to see some changing, and it was 5 years, and then 5 years, and then 5 years, and then it was. He didn't even get a 3-year denial. It went from 5 years straight to found suitable for parole. So it's not, it varies. It varies on what the demonstration of awareness is in the parole board hearing. Are you able to articulate, your accountability and culpability? And that's what the parole board bases it off of.
Okay. But just like, at the very least, like if a parole board meeting thing doesn't go well, you're a couple more years before your next one, at least.
Correct. Anywhere from 7 to 3 years.
Yeah,
I appreciate that. You're fine. I was just going to say the only thing I know about parole, my knowledge of how parole works begins and ends with Morgan Freeman in Shawshank Redemption.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
I know that much.
Because like my lifers, once Miller v. Alabama passed, Miller v. Alabama passed in 2012, which was to say like life without parole is illegal to give to juveniles, right? But then Montgomery v. Louisiana passed, and that said everything was retroactive. So that's like the lifers were getting ready to go to the parole board for that, and that's what we did.
Right. The process in California looks like this: is you go to what they call a committee date, mm-hmm. and you go to a committee, and they look at all your, your kind of your jacket, and they're like, okay, I'm going to go ahead and send this, report in, and let the board know that you're ready for a parole board date. And then it's up to you on how you present yourself to the board, and are you ready for that? And so there's numerous of this concept of parole board readiness and preparedness in most California prisons. There are prisoner-led groups that do this. Mm-hmm. And so I know in the press, everybody's been like, oh my God, this is a new thing. How come we don't know about this? Well, that's because nobody knows what the hell goes on in prison,
right?
And what doesn't go on in prison,
right?
And CDCR, California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, values these sorts of courses and classes because in the end, they don't want to be warehousing humans indefinitely. That's not a good look. Right. And you have to operate within the scope of the law. And the law says that we're not going to add punitive time onto someone if they've proven themselves to be rehabilitated. So that's where we come in, as we say, OK, we're going to look at this person, not the crime, because that's not what parole is about. You don't relitigate the crime. The crime is actually not even supposed to be brought up in a parole hearing.
Right.
What we are looking at is, what has this person done with their time while they've been incarcerated? What programs have they done? What extraordinary things have they done? We talk to correctional officers, we talk to staff, and we say, has this person gone above and beyond what most prisoners have done behaviorally? Have they helped? Have you seen this person help another prisoner? Have they ever helped you? Have you seen them mentor anybody? What's been your personal engagement with this person? And we get the staff to talk. And then if it's all positive, we ask them, can you please write a what we call a laudatory chrono for this person? And, that can't come from me. That has to come from the guys, my inside team, working with and having a good, respectable, trustworthy rapport with the law enforcement inside and administration. because no law enforcement, no correctional officer, no captain, lieutenant, sergeant is going to put their name on a laudatory chrono for one of California's most notorious criminals without it being true. That's right. A political risk for them. And in Sirhan's case, we had plenty of law enforcement inside the prison that deal with him on a day-to-day basis that see him more than anybody else, more than the lawyers, more than me, more than the Kennedy family, people who don't know, people out in the public that don't know a thing about prison rehabilitation, the letters from the inside staff who have nothing to gain by this,
right,
and everything to lose, are putting their neck out and saying, I work with this man. I see him in the kitchen working, you know, I see him in the housing unit. I'm the one who, you know, watches him at canteen, all of these things. This man does not need to be in prison any longer. He has more than been rehabilitated, you know, and they lean on his model behavior in a lot of mm-hmm. situations.
Yeah.
And so like, these are the things that people on the outside need to realize is, you know, when you get a lot of dissenters saying, oh, well, I can't believe the board did this. You know what they're saying is they don't have trust in the democratic institutions that are held to keep people in a state of rehabilitation. What they're saying is the panel, the parole board panel, who has a deep, rich history in law enforcement, their former district attorneys, wardens, cops, deputy prosecutors, these people have a very, very long professional career in law enforcement.
Yeah, they're not progressive.
People are saying, yeah,
parole board is not progressive at all in any state.
What the public is saying then is these people, one, don't know how to do their job right, which is absolute that, you know, there's all these prisoners that are conning their way past the board, which is definitely not true. It's easy to spot that, right? And second of all, begging Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, to not sign and to veto the paroles decision. Anybody that comes out with this kind of language, what they're ultimately and publicly asking is to operate outside of the scope of the law. And that is the biggest threat to democracy, not a Palestinian immigrant man who is 77 years old, who has done everything that's been asked of him and then some. It's the people on the outside wielding their white privilege in order to subvert democracy. That is the ultimate. When you hear people start talking about, oh, Newsom shouldn't do this and the board should do this. These are professional people that do this every day.
Yeah.
Damn. I bet I bet Aaron Burnett wasn't ready for that. I know I wasn't. So before we move on, I think we should, just because I don't know, just me being a dumbass, a lot of our fans are also maybe dumbasses. It's fine. Cool. We love you. For those who are like, who is Sirhan Sirhan?
For sure.
You can go ahead. I was just going to give the idiot's take, which...
Yeah, please. I'd love to hear it, because that's where I started. Yeah.
Cool. So basically, Sirhan Sirhan was convicted in the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy back in, what, late 60s, early 70s, something like that?
June 6th of 68, yeah.
Yeah, as Robert F. Kennedy was running for the Democratic primary nomination for president.
Yeah.
Right. He had just won California.
68. So in what he defended himself, like, there's a whole lot of fucking rabbit holes to go down with this story. I guess there's a lot of speculation that there was some kind of like CIA fucking brainwashing, like there's hypnotization. Sure. Like, I don't know
where to start with it,
but essentially. Oh, yes. Take over.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, for sure. What I can say is this, is I started off that way as well. And the intimate connection that I had with a lot of his case files, his psych eval reports, forensics in the case, inside documents that have been shared with me. Let me tell you this.
Mm-hmm.
Unequivocally, the evidence shows, the ballistics evidence shows, that there were two guns involved in the killing of Senator Kennedy. In fact, the bullets that were retrieved out of Senator Kennedy's body do not match Sirhan's gun.
Yeah, because I guess there was like, Sirhan was across the room And
he was in front of Senator Kennedy.
He was in front, and there was another shot that was behind the ear from behind.
Yeah, came in that was within an inch away of the back of his right, Senator Kennedy's right ear, in so much that there were powder burns on the skin. And the first bullet that actually made contact that came out of Sirhan's gun hit Paul Schrade. And that was an aide to Senator Kennedy, his labor advisor, and it hit him right in the head. It didn't kill him because Paul's still alive. But so there is two very separate ballistics in this case. Mm-hmm. There are blunders with the LA DA's office, LAPD, as you can imagine. It stinks. And I would say to your listeners that want to go down a rabbit hole, the first thing that I would recommend them is jump on YouTube. And
always a good place for reliable information about.
Well, there was right no, but there's a really good documentary that was put out, and it is older, but it's the biggest piece of comprehensive evidence that's been put together in a very long time, and it's called The Second Gun. Mm-hmm. And I think it has a profile of Robert F. Kennedy on there. I've seen it. I've seen the autopsy reports. I've seen the medical evidence. And it's, you know, I'm not a forensics expert, but I am open to a critical lens of looking at this. And when I see this, I can say that I am grounded in the data saying that Sirhan did not kill Senator Kennedy. It was not his bullets that did it. Yes, Sirhan brought a gun to the Ambassador Hotel, but his bullets were not in Senator Kennedy. And it's just, when you look at the evidence, you have to then at the same time say, this man has been held in prison and was put on death row to the gas chamber.
Yeah.
When he did not commit this crime. Yes, he shot five other people, but he's done the sentence for that.
Did any of them die? I didn't realize there was that many other people. No. Huh.
Yeah. So there's 12 or 13 shots that were pulled from the scene in an 8-shot gun. How does that occur?
It was in an episode of The Walking Dead.
Right. And Sirhan did not reload because there's iconic photos. As soon as he started shooting, everybody there, his arm was held. This is a 5'4", 130-pound little man, you know, and he was, you know, thrown onto a steam table and pinned down, and he still kept pulling the trigger. So, you know, I mean, this is common knowledge. So there was no time to reload. So that you have to eliminate that. If I'm standing in front of you 3 to 4 feet away with my arm stretched out, there's no way trajectory of a bullet is going to go past your ear and turn around and hit you in the back of the head. That's right. Not happening.
Definitely. So the last that, like I said, I listened to a podcast about this like a couple years ago. So that's why I'm like disjointed, like half remembered facts. The last thing I remember hearing about from Sirhan's perspective is he to that day, I guess, was maintaining that he had no recollection of the event, which is why there's like all the alleged like hypnotism or whatever, is that he doesn't remember doing this, and something about a woman with a polka dot dress. And also, from what I understand, that is why it has been difficult for him in previous parole meetings, is because he insists that he does not remember the events that happened. So is that where you walked in? Was he still like, is that where he was at whenever you met with him?
Sirhan still maintains that he does not remember the actual incident. And I don't think that's something that anybody can force. I would counter that and say, you know, there are a lot of people in the commission of their life crime that have been blackout drunk, that have had some sort of trauma where, you know, or I don't mean necessarily blackout drunk, but, you know, maybe under the influence of some sort of mind altering something, substance, that do not remember their crime. And they are released and found suitable for parole after they have done their time. You can't force somebody to remember something. It's just not there. So what ends up happening is this becomes, you know, just something that people can chew on. Oh, well, if he just admits it, then he'll be able to go home. Well, you know, he's not going to admit to something he doesn't remember.
Right.
That's just, he's just not gonna. And you know, I mean, everybody can say, well, if it were me, well, yeah, well, when you get to that position, you can come talk to me too.
Yeah. And so, if he's already been in jail for what, 60 years, I think if he was going to take that route, take he would have done exactly. it. Like,
right.
Stop saying it at and this he, point. Yeah.
And he maintains that I do not remember. And I honestly believe him. I really do. Based on what I know, the man doesn't remember. So, you know, it's, and I hate to use this analogy because I don't want people to conflate what I'm saying, but I hope everybody can understand.
Oh, you're in a place for messy analogies. Do not work.
You fit right in.
You know, but think about this. Think about people who get blackout drunk, get in their car and, you know, crash and kill a family of five on the side of the road, right? They don't remember this. But mm-hmm. they are found yep. suitable for parole later on. So, you know, it's we cannot continue to move the goalposts constantly for people. If you're going to say, okay, fine, you don't remember, we're not going to, you know, keep hounding you on this, then we have to look to your rehabilitative record. Have you done all the substance abuse classes? Have you maintained sobriety and all these other mitigating factors? Well, that's what we were going in with Sirhan. And it wasn't based upon he couldn't remember. There was many things with Sirhan that we were able to, over a year's time, really unpack of why he was not successful in his previous boards. And a lot of that was language. A lot of that was him understanding abstract concepts and applying it to his day-to-day life. And one I like to use is, for a long time, Sirhan was conflating anger and violence as one action. And so when the board would ask him, what do you do when you get angry, he says, well, I don't get angry, because he thinks that that is violence. And he's right. He's absolutely right. He is not a violent person. And so his response would be, well, I don't participate in it. I don't get angry. And I just kind of walk away as he's getting irritated, trying to explain this shit. Right. Mm-hmm. He didn't realize. And we didn't know if that was maybe a cultural thing or a language thing. There was a lot of things that could have, you know, been applied to why he could not separate the two. But once we figured that big giant component out, it was like, oh shit, you guys, we did it. We all felt like the Kool-Aid man, like we had bust through the wall of something really big.
Oh yeah.
No, seriously, because it was huge. And so we, like, the guys would sit and on a whiteboard and draw like this line, this continuum, you know, at the very, very end, we have violence. This is where action occurs.
Right.
You know, we have irritation all the way down here and you start to creep up on anger. And so, you know, they would, you know, say, so now that you understand this, give us some examples of when you've honestly felt angry and obviously didn't act on it. And so, of course, you know, he's like, you know, when I ran out of toilet paper and I was trying to get out to canteen and the cops wouldn't open up my door so I could go get in line to go get some more toilet paper, that irritated me. And he said, you know, I felt but he would never apply that in his parole board hearings. Right. He would just get away from it and say, I don't get angry, and go and talk in absolutes. Well, the board knows that this isn't true. Everybody gets angry. Everybody has triggers,
right?
Especially people in prison convicted of violent crimes.
Right. In an institution, you know?
Right. So it was able for him to unpack a lot of this stuff that nobody has ever worked with him before, you know, and it was me sending in a lot of curriculum and academic readings for him that were geared especially for him, that my inside team has already been working with over the years. So they were able to sit down with him and say, okay, so do you remember on page 2, you know, when it was talking about identity, and he would say, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then it was like, okay, cool. So tell us, what does that mean to you? And they would have just these really good conversations. And these took place, you know, well, like I said, a year, and having these little mini breakthroughs with these concepts that he was just not able to articulate or unpack, he now understood them. And so when he went into board, he nailed it. I mean, this guy, I was so proud of him, and it was very heartfelt. He applied all the things that he's been working on. At the very beginning of the parole board hearing, the commissioner was trying to trigger him on purpose to see how he would react. And so the commissioner
to get him angry or something,
get him angry, get him emotional, get him off his square. And it looked like, you know, to talk to us about, you know, your trauma living in Palestine, you know, in a war. And that is that, I mean, it comes right to his face immediately. It's just like, he's a little boy again, right there in West Jerusalem. And he is, you know, pulling up dead people's limbs, you know, out of a water well and seeing, you know, elders in the family, you know, die, and his brother being ran over by a military truck. And it's very apparent.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Yeah, you know, it's terrible. And he became highly emotional and cried, and it was hard for him to recover. He had to ask a couple of times to kind of, you know, take a minute and collect himself. And, you know, my heart is watching him go through these emotions because I'm right there on screen with him. And I was so proud of him because he came back and he said, you know, because it's emotional because these are my people. He said, this is my kinfolk. And it's hard to watch and see the brutality and the oppression, you know, that has occurred from, you know, this situation. And the commissioner asked him, he said, well, don't you have empathy for the Israeli children that suffered the same thing? And
I'm getting mad.
right. And but you know what? Sirhan, he delivered this masterclass response. And he said, with all due respect, I never saw any Israeli children. And that hit home. Mm-hmm. That really hit home. And that ended the line of questioning. And they moved on to something else. And in that case in the past, that has not been the case. He will continue to get mad and push back on it. But he knew this time, you know, I'm going to make my comment and it's going to be concise. I'm not going to drag it out. And it's going to be from the heart. And that's exactly how it came off. Even when he read his closing statement in the hearing, that was, you know, he wrote that as this heartfelt plea. And he addressed every member of the Kennedy family and the victims. And after he was finished reading that, Doug Kennedy, when he gave his statement, he said, you know, your picture in the press and your name for as long as I've, you know, since I've been a little boy has invoked fear in me.
What is Doug Kennedy's relation? Sorry.
That was his father, okay. Robert F. Kennedy. Yeah. Senator Kennedy. That was his father. And so, younger brother of Robert Jr. And so he said, you know, from a little boy, your name has just really terrorized me. He said, but now, he said, I'm listening to you. I'm looking at you. And he said, you are a man that's worthy of love and compassion.
Wow.
And it was really like, I got goosebumps. I had to turn my camera off because I got emotional. And Sirhan broke down and cried. And it was a really endearing moment that everybody, I think, you know, that has a heart shared that was on that panel. Robert Kennedy Jr. had a statement that was read in that hearing saying that he supports Sirhan's release and that he also does not believe that Sirhan killed his father and that there was a second gun involved. And strongly, strongly advocates on that basis alone. So I know that Robert Jr. is trying to, you know, put together a face-to-face with Governor Newsom so they can talk about, you know, the mitigating factors of Sirhan's parole and possibly taking a closer look into the case. So, yes, it's a big deal. It's a big deal.
Definitely. And, yeah.
It was a surreal moment. You know, here I am used to, you know, telling guys in prison to, you know, stop acting like fucking babies to, you know, sitting on a parole panel sandwiched between two Kennedys, you know, advocating on, you know, the suitability of, you know, a cultural and iconic historical figure in our nation's history. And, you know, it was very, it was very, very surreal, that moment. I will never forget that. And when, you know, Sirhan comes and sits down and he would wave, "Hi, Jenny," you know, and it was just like, yeah, I mean, here's a man who had the faith and trust in me to put his life in my hands,
yeah,
and say, I'm 77 years old. This may be my last chance, you know, of, yeah, of coming out of prison. And I believe that you can get me to that point. And he believed in my team to help him get through the obstacles that he has faced, you know, the past 15, 16 times. And we all work together as this really close-knit group to really help him find the insight that he needed and that he was lacking. And that was all the insight. They did that. And I'm really proud of them.
Yeah. It brings me to tears to hear you talk about it.
Is this two patrons in a week?
I know. No, but like it does, it brings me, because one, I mean, I think, you know, it's amazing for you to be able to, you know, experience this, and you did such an amazing job. And it just gives me hope that like other people will see that these guys, mm-hmm, there's a life inside them. They're not just prisoners.
Right.
You know, like when I did the lifer stuff, both times that my guys did their statement about, you know, their being rehabilitated and how they, you know, feel about, you know, their remorse in, you know, their part in this crime. I had to leave both times because it was just so heartbreaking, you, mm-hmm, know, and I feel for the victims. Yeah, I absolutely feel for the victims, but this person is just not a defendant, you know, and I think, right, that's like the mm-hmm, most important part of like that mitigation process, you know.
Right.
I've never, yeah, done one for parole. I've always done one, you know, either for children being, you know, charged adults or,
right,
you know, the juveniles being resentenced. But the mitigation piece is what is missing a lot in these courtrooms. Mm-hmm. And that mitigation piece can make or break a case, because there's people that will not go through all that paperwork. I mean, I can imagine the paperwork that you fucking went through for those.
For 53 years.
Yeah.
53 years. Yes.
And some of that paperwork, it's so hard to get. Like, I remember with my one guy, I couldn't get like three of his records from placements because they had been closed down, and they didn't, like, it was the 80s. You know what I mean? Yep. Like, and you, yep, had to go through like 53 years. It's a lot of work. People, yep, don't, there's not a lot of people that are willing to take the time to do it. Mm-hmm. Mitigation specialists will. And the thing is it's so fucking important. Like, it is such an, like, what you did was so important. Mm-hmm. You know, and mm-hmm, I mean, your guys are just like, they're amazing. I mean,
they are. They all, the best part of this whole story, it is, they had, received word, my inside team, that, Sirhan had been found suitable for parole. And for whatever reason that day, there was no yard running. So there was nobody in the prison yard, except my team was out there. And they were waiting at the gate when Sirhan was being walked back from the hearing. Now, Sirhan didn't know that they knew. So he was trying to be a jokester and be extremely deadpan,
uh-huh,
right? And he comes walking, you know, to the gate, and he sees them all standing there with, you know, these bright faces, like excited, waiting to hear the news. And he doesn't know that they know. And he's kind of like, "What? Like, what do you want?" You know, kind of a thing. And they all were like, "Get in here. We already know. Stop playing with us." And they literally like just dogpiled this guy, this little old man, lifted him up on their shoulders. Everybody was crying. I mean, you had just a group of men that just broke down because, you know, they had put so much time and effort during the peak of COVID, when guys are literally dying in their cells.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They're risking their own lives to meet and work with, you know, Sirhan, and, you know, operate within the COVID protocols and the lockdown orders and like this was a labor of love. And so there was a lot of emotion involved and it was so cute. I guess he was like, put me down. And, he wanted to go over to the canteen and buy everybody ice cream. And they were like, no, yeah, I know. Right. And they said, no. Like, we got you. Like, we're going to walk you back to your cell. And the whole team walked him back to his cell. I guess when they walked in, everybody had already heard the news and everybody was cheering. The whole housing unit went up in applause. They started chanting Sirhan's name. They started chanting Redemption Row. And it was just an amazing wave of emotion for everyone. And since then, my guys have gone out and notified everybody in the yard, and especially in his housing unit, like, listen, this man is untouchable. Don't mess with him. And we will be randomly checking on him. You never know who it's going to be. So act accordingly. You know, you're still going to have, you know, the ones that are going to get mad and they're going to want to make a name for themselves.
Right.
He's already been attempts on his life twice. A few years ago, he had his throat cut on the yard. A couple of my guys actually witnessed it and said what a horrible scene that was. But even in that moment of situational violence, he didn't respond violently. He literally, and later on, he said, Sirhan said that the reason he didn't, I guess he just grabbed his neck and he just slowly started walking off the yard to get medical. He said, because I knew if I got my heart raised up, it's going to start pumping more and I'll bleed out by the time I get there.
Jesus Christ.
He had the wherewithal to like keep
understand.
That,
yeah.
understand that. And, you know, and, you know, it's like that situation in any time that he's been confronted with violence, even on himself, he hasn't responded violently. So the man is very, very passive. He's not a pushover, but he will do anything to avoid any kind of violence or any kind of confrontation. And now that he knows that, you know, there's a separation between violence and, you know, conflict, and now he's trained in conflict resolution by my guys, this man's going to be a solid person. And he just wants to live out the rest of his days in Pasadena with his brother. You know,
like, oh yeah, his brother still lives in the same house,
the family house
from 3 years ago.
Exactly.
No, so.
he's been taking care of Manure, his brother. He and I talk at least once a week. But Manure has been taking care of Sirhan's lemon tree that he planted as a boy.
Oh my gosh!
Wow. I know,
my freaking heart.
I know. And Manure is almost blind, and so Sirhan would be his primary caregiver. And Manure is the only living member of the family. Everybody else has died. And it's just really sad. And, you know, I mean, it's sad. The whole thing is sad all the way around, no matter how far down the rabbit hole you want to get. If this man was taken advantage of by a system of oppressing power, if this man was set up, you know, there was already a really good model with Lee Harvey. They were like, hey, we might want to continue this. It looked like the same when you had, you know, the guy who had just assassinated Martin Luther King, you know, months before. Right. So, you know, this was kind of a working model that, you know, that was used to find people that were powerless to take the fall for these, you know, this giant, you know, memorable moment in our nation's history where, you know, leaders are being assassinated left and right. So I think there's hurt all over. There's, you know, systemic hurt. You know, there's, you know, you have to understand, like, how did Sirhan even get to the United States in the first place?
Right.
Right. Right. That's a whole nother story, you know, and why is that a thing, you know, and we have to look at youth offender laws. You know, he was 24 when it occurred.
Right.
Right. His brain wasn't fully developed yet. We have to look at, you know, the use of the death penalty in his case. We have to look at life, you know, life sentences for murder one, which is what he was convicted of. No more, no less. You know, he was not convicted of a political crime. We have to look at elderly eligibility requirements and laws that, you know, you have an aging population in prison now. And what are their mitigation factors? And so
what are the statistics of septuagenarians getting out and committing more crimes?
Like,
Yeah, it's like less than fucking.
It's less than 1%.
Yeah, yeah. it's less than 1%.
In fact, property. If you're convicted of a property crime, you're most likely to reoffend than you are a violent crime.
Yep.
And so Sirhan literally covers all of every single thing that you can possibly cover on the spectrum of who he represents.
Yeah.
Right. And on top of it, you know, he's got an immigration issue. So, I mean, he's really, you know, quite at the bottom of people that, you know, are easily put aside. But when we start highlighting all these things that he does represent, it's, you cannot look away. And that's what makes his case really important, is, and that's what the prison population is, was understanding, is that he does represent all of them.
Right.
All of them. It's the only people he does not represent is the LGBTQ community. And they were behind him. Hmm. Right. And so it was, you know, you have understand this. You have people from cross groups. Okay. And prison is the most highly segregated place.
Right.
You have people who represent prison politic hierarchy that came together and said, we are all going to work together for this person because we feel so strongly that he represents all of us. And in this time where this man cannot get programming because of COVID, we have to pick up the mantle. And this is what they were trained to do anyway.
Right.
Right. They did exactly what they were trained to do. Period. And we came out of it with a positive result. I mean, that's just the first hoop we got to get through. We still have to get through all of this other nutty behavior of people asking the parole board to go rogue.
Right.
You know, but ultimately, I really believe that this man will be coming home.
I have two questions, and they are both serious questions. However, the second one is far stupider. First of all, so like how close is he to a final decision? Like, so this obviously was an important step. What steps remain before it's like, okay, yes or no, you get to leave?
So it's under review for 90 days, I believe, at the full panel. And then mm-hmm. it goes to the governor for a 30-day review. So all in all, 120 days as of 8/27 is, so that we're clicking away. And there's a huge, we're going to be, his defense team and myself and with Redemption Row, we are coming out with a really strong public campaign to inform people about the process because so many people are following it. Mm-hmm. We'll be having our own website. We'll have a lot of documentation up there. We'll have links to a lot of things to discussion points, things to think about, I think. So there's going to be, it's going to be a really comprehensive view of Sirhan and what going forward looks like post hearing.
So 90 days plus 30 more, so 120 days, if it gets to the end of that, is that all it needs, or just, is there something else that they have to do? Is it like they have 120 days to shoot it down? And if they don't, it happens.
Right. Well, I'm not too sure if it's an automatic. I mean, I should have taken that class in California politics, but I didn't.
it's okay. I should have taken more than a single semester that I failed all my classes in college. You're fine.
I should have became a social worker.
So I think it could be kind of a decision, or it just gets automatically approved, but I'm not too sure. I do know that there's, you know, kind of safety nets, that can be applied. You know, I know like his legal team is ready to go in with a writ to the Court of Appeals at any point in time in the process gets shut down. And, you know, I would imagine that the California Supreme Court would look at this and look at the data and not be influenced by personal bias or outside influences. Right. And the thing of it is, again, I cannot say this enough. If you are looking at his criteria for eligibility, Sirhan falls well within the scope, if not has set a benchmark of rehabilitation, and any means to divert from that is being subversive to democratic institutions.
So my second question, as I said, still very serious, but much stupider. Has Sirhan expressed any interest in, so he's been in prison a long time, does he know where he wants to go and eat first?
You know, that's a great question. I have, I have asked that question.
Yes, I have.
Because that's a big thing for me. Food is like a huge thing. Plus, I mean, it's like, what is that one thing? And I'm going to remind my team to get an answer for me. But I do know that he has said that when that time comes, he said,
to the chest.
No. He said, when that time comes, he told my inside team that he definitely wanted myself and another woman on the defense team that he said, because we're actually the closest in geography to him. Mm-hmm. But he said, I want, you know, Jenny to come pick me up. I want her to drive me home. And I was like, all right, like, let's do that. Like, can you imagine? like, can you imagine that? Like, that's going to be super surreal. And so obviously then.
Tell him we said hi.
The click in would obviously, the obvious would be, you know, well, where are we going to go eat right now? Where do you want to go? You know? And so, yeah, I'm always interested in what those first meals look like. That's important.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah.
Also, it would be all I was thinking about for 53 years is, am I ever going to have McDonald's again?
Right. And, you know, what do you want? Like, what do you want? I know he wants to go to the beach and just walk and see the ocean.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, I'm like, we'll do that. I promise you, we will take you there and we're going to all have that moment. I do know that they did have their little ice cream party.
Okay.
That did occur. He went over with his pillowcase to the canteen and he bought them all pints of Haagen-Dazs ice cream and Snickers bars. And he went around and he gave it to the whole team and they all hung out together and visited for a long time the other day and all just had this really good, you know, moment. For the first time he actually has friends now, and these friends are the best friends in the system. These are really heavy hitters in the prison culture world, and to have these guys be your friend and genuinely care. And individual team members of mine will go and check on him, you know, occasionally throughout the day, one year, you know, just to see, you know, what do you need? Do you need anything going on, you know, and just keep him, you know, close to the heart, because this man's going through a lot right now. And he's really opened up with a lot of his, you know, he hasn't trusted anybody. Can you imagine not having a friend for 53 years?
Oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, like, just that, not only just the physical isolation you had from being in solitary confinement and on death row, but the personal isolation that you must maintain, right? You get, you know, there's two attempts on your life. You don't know who's your friend and who isn't.
Yeah.
And now he has this whole crew of people, these crew of badass people that are fighting for him inside and out. And he's just overwhelmed. And he's just, it's brought a lot of his own confidence out and a lot of his ability to share things. And so, yeah, I love the relationship that he is now having with a lot of the members, or all the members of Redemption Row, and how they all uniquely bring something different to his life and vice versa.
Right.
You know,
that's really beautiful.
Yeah. It really is. I mean, cause you have a really diverse group of guys. I mean, these are like heavy hitter, like, you know, people talk about, you know, how easy is it to rehabilitate like neo-Nazis and can people, Jen has played a role in that.
Jen, what would you say, easy or not easy?
You know, I do work with a lot of active gang members inside prison, but a lot of the heart and soul of what I have learned has come from those that have de-radicalized. Right. And so it's having these strong conversations with them. How did they get in this movement? What kept them in? And, you know, this is different than street Nazis, you know, because there is a lot of, obviously, a lot of the same kind of philosophies. However, once you get inside prison, it's completely different. The politics of that is, there's not a lot of crossover. It's almost like, there's not, let me just say this, there's not too many people out there from all different backgrounds that are what we call unaffiliated, right? And so because there's these protective associations that are set up inside to interpolice, because the last thing anybody in prison wants is a prison riot or a fight,
right?
And so, but you know, and that's, and there's actual data behind the fact that during the proliferation of prison gangs in California, during this huge movement where you find more and more and more prison gangs, the homicide and the violence rate has actually decreased. And that's according to CDCR's own reports. So prison gangs actually do keep the violence down inside the facilities. And, you know, that's, you know, it's predominantly because it's not based on race. It's actually based on the market of illicit goods, right?
Yeah.
So if you create a scene or a riot on the yard, everything gets shut on lockdown and commerce stops. So there's an incentive to keep the peace.
Right.
Right.
Ironically, capitalism saves the day.
And I mean, that's really it. And I've done plenty of studies, and I sit in rooms with these men, right? And they will, most of them will actually tell you, you're like, yeah, you're spot on, Jen. It's all about, you know, the commerce here, the black market, if you will, of, you know, contraband X, Y, and Z things. It's not based on racial stuff. He's like, you know, as this is very true. So as the wealth inequality gap continues to increase, a lot of neighborhoods become blended on the periphery, right?
Right.
So yeah. So things are based on geography, not necessarily on race. So you have to keep that like in mind. So when we go inside prison, there's going to be a lot of like, oh, I remember so-and-so, but he's, you know, he's this Mexican guy, and he used to hang out with all the white boys on the street. Well, why is that? Maybe it's where he lived, right? It's all about your zip code,
right?
Right, and in your neighborhood, and those are defined by your earnings and what, you know. So it's very, although it happens just because it's prison and they have to police each other, but it's as we see the rise and the death rattle of capitalism, we start to see that a lot of these groups become blended. Just by nature. Yeah.
Well, this has been really interesting. I don't really have any other questions. Was there, Maria, did you have anything?
No, I just wanted to see Jen's beautiful face and also give her the opportunity to talk about Redemption Row, California. Get my shit together, I really want to talk to you about trying to do something in Pennsylvania. You know,
yeah.
I mean, trying to figure out, like, you know, shit's been weird here, just like with juvenile justice stuff. You know, I haven't done like any of the lifer stuff because it was kind of, you know, I put it on hold or whatever. But I mean, there are tons of people that have gotten life without the possibility of parole in the state of Pennsylvania at age 19, 20, 21. You know, and even just looking at like just explaining to people how like the criminal justice system and how prisons in general, you know, traumatize people, and how we can, you know, change that. And how these programs are really important because, you know, it's changing lives, and we really we need to really invest in that more.
I believe so. I think all prison rehabilitation is necessary because everybody gets something out of everything. But I think there needs to be a real stronger push for evidence-based programming.
Yeah.
Because this is, you know, it looks great that you, you know, took, you know, this music class to learn how to play the flute. That's awesome. Right. That makes someone could possibly introduce them into something that they never, you know, knew that they were good at, and it felt good to them. And that's great. I'm all about that. But what the board is ultimately looking at and what they give great weight to are the programs that are backed by data. Mm-hmm. And we need researchers out there really studying these programs. We need to be funding evidence-based programs more than these feel-good programs. Mm-hmm. And I would say that if that is, you know, we give, you know, these multi-million dollar grants to programs that have no data behind them. And then organizations like mine, we have to rely on public donations, right? So it's, I don't know.
Which frustrating, to say the least.
I would like to also then shamelessly plug redemptionrowcalifornia.com. You can go there to donate. We take PayPal and Cash App and Venmo. And
yeah, listeners, if you can afford to give us money, you can give Jen
give Jen money.
It seems like, you know, it's hard to... If you, I mean, it's like maybe apples and oranges, but if you want to compare the good in the world we are doing with this podcast to Jen's
give work, Jen money.
Give Jen,
you know, but it's cool too, because I've given Jen money before the guys had a pizza party.
That's right.
Wait, can I buy Sirhan's first McDonald's after he gets out?
That was a few summers ago, but I did. I drugged like 20 plus extra large pizzas into a prison with me, and they x-rayed all of them, and I had like 12 boxes of donuts. It was a lot of fun, but the guys, they absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
But I also have a Patreon page. So if you want to hit it, $5 a month, it's all the links are on the donate page on our website. So
we'll put the link on our thing.
Thank you. Any social medias or anything you want them to follow?
We're at Redemption Row, on Twitter. We do have a TikTok, Redemption Row. You can find me on Facebook. Jay Deuce is my name on Facebook, and Redemption Row California has an Instagram as well. I believe it's at Redemption Row CA. So we're just getting started with our social media because, you know, sometimes it's hard in prison to get content. Mm-hmm. So I just don't have a whole lot of content to push out right now, but we're working on it. And the more, more my team is able to meet, the more content I'll be able to get. And that's how social media works. But I'd love the follow.
Awesome. Yes. Well, thank you again so much for joining us and answering all of the brilliant questions that me and Maria have posed to you, and for doing this important work. And yeah, it was really nice to have you on.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for listening. Putting us in your ears. We love you.
Yeah.
Very
thank
much.
Thank you. We love you very much.